paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, and thanks for being here. And again, sitting in for Lisa Platt during this time of COVID-19. I'm Kyle Bailey. As we continue the program's shift to looking at public health news and information in depth, and we're joined again today by County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and also Laura Turpin, who is an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Douglas Public Health Network. Folks, thanks for being on with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Bob, first of all, we're going to go a lot of different directions today, but kind of give us a Douglas County view at just where things stand today with this COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, from the world view, it's still pretty grim. World Health Organization said today the worst is yet ahead of us, and I believe it is. We're still seeing large outbreaks in Europe. Now we're starting to see big outbreaks in South America, and we're seeing a resurgence of the disease in Singapore, a country that really had this under control. So throughout the rest of the world, it's kind of a scary time. In the U.S., I think we've reached the peak in New York and New Jersey, but they still have a lot of disease and a lot of sick people, a lot of people in the hospitals. They especially have dealt with lots of disease in nursing homes, and there have been really a tragic number of deaths. Nursing homes. Also in this country, we're starting to see outbreaks in more rural areas. So the big outbreak in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in a Smithfield meat plant, and several other now large agricultural plants have had outbreaks. We're also seeing big outbreaks in jails. You can imagine in jails, it's very hard to socially distance, and these people are spreading. The good news is in those outbreaks, there's not been a lot of deaths associated with that. But unfortunately, what we know is that, for example, in the meat plant, that these people will go home, maybe to elderly relatives, and can spread the disease there. So the rest of the country, kind of up and down news. In Oregon, we're still having an increased number of cases, although the increased number of cases has been really very steady over the last 2 weeks. So I think Oregon is not really, if you think of this like a mountain range, this is a low, slow mountain, more like the Coast Range than the Cascades. And so we've been between 20 and 100 cases a day now for about 2 weeks, and I think this is what we're going to see. In Douglas County, we're just at 23 cases. We lost one case because they really lived in another area, and then gained one case today, which was a contact of previous cases. So we're still at 23 total cases, and about 10 have recovered. We may have had a few new recoveries today. So again, we're about 23 cases, 10 recoveries, 13 active cases. And of those cases, thank goodness, we've had no deaths. We have two people still in the hospital out of that 23.
Well, so for folks in Douglas County, this has been a very tough, very trying time for everyone involved, and for those of you working in public health, have you ever experienced anything even close to what we're dealing with right now in terms of the response it's taking from your staff, your workers, people like that?
So we occasionally have a day or two where it gets really busy when there's an outbreak of something bad, but that's usually only a day or two. This has been 2 months now of heavy, sustained effort. And we really have such a great team here. We really are working on this 24/7. Laura worked over the weekend. Kristen worked over the weekend to go through all of the cases. And if we do get a new case, to track it down. So this has been truly a 100-year pandemic. And really the last time we had a pandemic like this was back in 1918 when there was the Spanish flu. And that was just a bit before my time.
Well, and what can we learn, though, from the Spanish flu pandemic?
So we can learn a few things. One is the Spanish got credited with this pandemic. It really had nothing to do with Spain. It really started actually in the U.S. and Kansas. So I think one of the things we're going to learn is we don't want to go ahead and denigrate a group from this, and I think calling this COVID-19 is a good way to do it. I think the other thing that we learned from it is that the places that instituted early social distancing did better than places that did not. So Philadelphia was a place that they were really urged to socially distance. They decided instead to hold a parade, and in the weeks that followed this, they had a tremendously terrible outbreak of flu in Philadelphia that killed many, many people, and some just harrowing stories. So for whatever reason, in that flu, children did not seem to get as sick as young adults. So the stories that these houses would be locked up, and days later they would come, all the adults would be dead, and the kids would be wandering around looking for things to eat. So really just these horrible stories of what happens if when pandemic spreads to that level. Now, thank God we've not had that kind of story here, although some of the stories in nursing homes are just absolutely heartbreaking.
Right, and we, in fact, we're going to be covering tomorrow a little bit about what one facility is doing to help folks with that, and that happens to be the Roseburg VA. We haven't posted the story yet, but they have implemented a program with virtual visits, and we'll have more information about that up tomorrow at 541radio.com. But it seems like people are looking for, taking the technology we have that would normally be used in other ways that we're more used to, and trying to help folks out with this. I mean, everything in life seems to be virtual now, including interviews on the radio.
Believe it or not, we have. And I think we've learned that some of the virtual ways of interacting are okay. Well, I think for many of our seniors, they're going to be a little less adept at using technology. And so we really have to worry about this group. What we've seen in nursing homes is usually the disease is brought in by staff members who are generally young and otherwise quite healthy. And they may be carrying this disease either mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic and then spread it to the residents. So that's how we think this gets into nursing.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, also Laura Turpin, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Douglas Public Health Network. Some of us on the radio are still trying to say epidemiologist correctly. It's not a term a lot of people are familiar with. And Laura, though we covered this once before, explain to folks just what it is you do.
Well, I have friends of mine that call me a diseaseologist, so if that's easier for people to understand. But an epidemiologist is just somebody who studies outbreaks or epidemics of disease.
And talk about what kind of background you have to end up with that kind of role.
So usually people study public health or epidemiology or biostatistics or a related field. I got my master's at Tulane University, and I've been working here for 2 years.
And you also mentioned the last time we had you on, if I recall correctly, about working over in Africa as well?
Yes. Yeah, so prior to living in Douglas County, I lived in the Gambia in West Africa, where I did mostly malaria prevention work and tracing malaria contacts.
And what organization were you working for with that?
That was with the United States Peace Corps, 27 months stint that I went over there.
Talk about how different healthcare is in a location like that.
It's a lot different, and I definitely been communicating with my former coworkers and friends over there, and they are also grappling with COVID-19, and they just have far less resources than we do here.
Wow. So, Dr. Bob, one of the things that you've talked about along the way and with the leadership here in Douglas County of doing these drive-through tests. Now, you have another one scheduled for tomorrow, right?
We do indeed. We've done 13 so far, and our 14th tomorrow.
And are we still on the two-a-week schedule?
We're still doing two a week, although we've had actually much lower participation over the last few weeks. We think the acronyms of the disease is down. We've now opened up the clinic to anybody who gets an order from their doctor. So there are some asymptomatic people who want to be screened. We'll even screen asymptomatic people at this point.
So at this point, though, folks still need to go through their doctor, and then it's the doctor that essentially refers the patient to the drive-through clinic, correct?
That is correct. And it's a very easy process for the doctor, so it doesn't take more than a few minutes. But we really want people to be connected to a primary care doctor. And if you don't have a primary care doctor, the people at Evergreen will see you. The people at Nova might see you, too. They're not seeing people on OHP, but everybody else, if you don't have a doctor, you can go to Nova, and they can refer you for tests.
So what will it take to get testing ramped up? One of the things I read over the weekend was that in Oregon, it seemed like there had been a bit of a lag at getting things ramped up here.
So to get testing ramped up, there's at least six different stages. The first is you need to have the swabs to do it, and there's been a real shortage of those swabs. You need to have the transport media, which is this brothy stuff that you put it in that helps the virus to grow. You need to have the protective equipment to get it done, and that protective equipment consists of a good quality mask, gloves, and a gown, and those are in short supply. You then need to have a lab that will do it, a fairly rapid turnaround time. So you remember in the beginning we had a turnaround time of over a week. That was really not particularly acceptable. We're now down to just a few days, so that's getting better. It would be nice to be overnight, but we want to get the test lag down. And then you have to have somebody like Laura to follow up on the test results so that they are positive to get your contacts so we can quarantine and or test them. So really when people talk about robust testing, it's not just the lab, it's not just the swabs, it's all of those things together. My sense is we will have the testing thing solved when it's as easy as getting a strep test at your doctor's office. 20, 30 different places around town that have that. People have all the equipment. People have all the turnaround time. They've got all of that stuff going. We're not close to that yet with COVID.
And what kind of timeline are you hoping for to get to that point?
Well, if you remember when we started back in March, we had none of those things. We now have better turnaround time, a little bit more test capacity, some supplies of swabs, and slightly better PPE situation. So I think we're working our way there. But to get this, we're going to need to do lots of testing and have something at every step there. So when people talk about, oh, you know, there's excess capacity at the labs, maybe there really isn't the kind of capacity that we would want.
I've noticed looking at the Oregon Health Authority daily updates, sometimes a victim, a person who has passed away after getting COVID-19, they always list a date that they tested positive and then when they died. And sometimes it may have been within the past day or two before it's reported. Sometimes, though, it's been several days before it's reported. And I'm curious as to why that is.
So some of the people are tested as they enter the hospital and they're very sick. They get tested on that day and die quickly. Other people are tested and then get sick and are in the ICU. And unfortunately, what we've seen with this disease is very long ICU stays. So ICU stays of a week or two or even longer where people are sick, and then you have that delay between the time they were tested and the time they actually died.
Sometimes, though, from the time they've passed away to the time it's reported is several additional days as well.
That may be because some of these tests are done post-mortem. So if we have somebody who dies of an illness that could be COVID, we are doing the test after death, and then it would be delayed several days after their death.
And does the amount of time it takes to get these tests back, does that still seem to vary as much, maybe depending geographically on where you are or just what the testing volume is at a particular time?
Well, what we think was happening in the past is the tests would build up in the labs, and the labs would do them in the order they were received, and so you'd sometimes wait days and days to get it done. In addition, early on, many of the tests were not done because of some technical problems, but I think we've gotten it straightened out. So, for example, in the testing that we did on Friday, it was all back by this morning. And so that's a pretty good turnaround time, and we've had no rejections in the last five clinics we've done.
All right, going to take a break. We're going to be back in a moment. Our next segment on the way, County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Douglas Public Health Network. Kyle Bailey in for Lisa Platt. It's Talking Health. Back in 2 minutes on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, there we go, 4:23, the afternoon report coming up at 5 with Douglas County's news team. And for Lisa Platt, I'm Kyle Bailey with another special Talking Health program focusing on COVID-19 and the Douglas Public Health Network. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, infectious disease epidemiologist at DPHN. Dr. Bob, you mentioned, this is really a seven-day effort. You talked about people working over the weekend. How is your staff doing at getting occasional doses of time off?
Well, we try very hard to encourage healthy living by our people, get exercise, and get out and enjoy the sunshine. So we're encouraging that. But we have a group of incredibly dedicated people here who it's pretty hard to convince them to take good care of themselves.
And what did you notice over the weekend in terms of social distancing as you were maybe out and about a bit?
So we went to Reesport this weekend to do a swabbing clinic there. So we got a chance to see a little bit about what's happening out there. I think overall people are doing a very nice job with social distancing. You see occasional lapses in that, but for the most part, I think people are doing pretty well. We're not seeing as much mask use as would be recommended. So the recommendation is that when you're out in public and are unsure of social distancing, you should wear a face covering. And I was maybe a quarter of the people who had face coverings. So we could probably do a little bit better there.
I wonder if some of that depends on where folks are going. I noticed, and I was not out as much this past weekend as I probably normally am, but when I was in a couple of larger grocery, et cetera, stores, it was probably about 40% of the people I saw that were wearing masks. That was up, quite a bit from the previous weekend.
Well, wearing a mask is sort of an unusual thing. It took me a little while to get used to it. Now I'm wearing my balaclavas, and they seem to work out pretty well. But, yeah, it's going to be a cultural change for people in the U.S.
We're going to kind of unmask masks in this segment a bit because we've talked about what a tremendous change it has been. In fact, even this morning, I was caught off guard just ahead of our morning report at 7, and I was contemplating about four different things and wrapping up some details and getting things ready to get the morning news on the radio. And from my cubicle, I can see through our break room out into the parking lot, though it's a ways away. I've got a clear shot view. And a vehicle pulled in, not quite sure. I think they were just cutting through the parking lot, frankly. But I looked over, and a person in this pickup was wearing a mask. And I actually had a momentary shudder. It's like, whoa, wait. And then after about 10 seconds, I went, oh, yeah, this is becoming normal. It is still, when I see, I guess I'm used to seeing people in stores now, but when I see people driving with masks, that one still surprises me a bit. What is your guidance about wearing masks, for instance, when you're out driving by yourself?
Well, when you're out driving by yourself, a mask is not necessary, although there are some people who just put the mask on in the morning and just leave it on during the day, and that's perfectly acceptable. We certainly have seen some people, especially people in big cities, who fear wearing a mask because of the negative connotations of wearing a mask and it being associated with crime. So this is going to be something that will take a little bit of time to get over.
Well, it is definitely a new world when it comes to that. I've got a mask. I have tried it on. Apparently, I'm still not, haven't got it fitted exactly right, but it's certainly just been an oddity for me to even be dealing with that. For masks, we've covered it before, but because this is evolving ground, explain the differences in the different types of masks that are out there and what people should get for the need they might have?
So we start with the highest level of masks, which are the ones that are the N99-7s, and those are used for extraordinarily contagious things like Ebola. Almost nobody has a need to use those. We then have N95 masks, which are the masks that people use in the hospital that block 95% of the small particles and are thought to give excellent protection against COVID. Those are typically not very expensive in the other time, but now they're going for about $5 a piece, and they're hard to come by. So we're asking that those only be used at times where people are going to be around aerosol-generating procedures, like putting a tube in somebody's lungs or suctioning out somebody's lungs. Then next comes surgical or procedure masks. Those are the ones that are typically made of paper, impregnated paper, and those fit quite nicely. I think that's what we recommend for most healthcare workers who are not part of aerosol-generating procedures. And then we have the cloth masks or the cloth face covering, which could be masks, balaclavas, or a bandana. Those are actually most effective in preventing me from spreading it to somebody else. They may be somewhat effective in preventing me from getting it, but most effective in preventing the person who is pre-symptomatic, that's not they haven't yet developed symptoms, but could be contagious, from spreading it to others.
And a number of local groups, two in particular, plus a lot of people just doing things on their own, have been out creating a lot of masks. Is there a scenario when these start coming from traditional manufacturing facilities, you know, even clothes makers or people like that? What are you hearing?
Well, there are some clothes makers that are making these masks, but I think the ones made by the local craftspeople are so neat. They're usually good looking. They're usually fit well. And they're just a local product. We've distributed over 6,000 of these at no cost to anyone. So I support the several groups around the county that are making these.
Well, definitely a lot of interest in that. We even heard about one local winery over the weekend that has someone making masks for members of their wine club. A lot of people jumping on board with it. For someone who might still be reluctant, though, and just feel really uncomfortable about the whole idea, from the medical side, kind of explain the difference in wearing and not wearing a mask and why you feel like that's important.
So we do know in this disease that people may spread the disease a day or two before they come up with symptoms, or they may spread the disease not having symptoms at all. And really, wearing a mask is not so much for you, it's for the people you're around. So imagine if I go to the grocery store and I get fairly close with the person who's the checker, and I'm asymptomatic and spread it to them. Think of how terrible you would feel if you later found out that you were asymptomatic, but you were the one who spread it to the wonderful person at the grocery store, if you were the person who spread it to your spouse. So that's the reason we're recommending that people use face covering, not so much to protect you, but for you to protect others.
And do you feel like more folks wearing masks, just the sort of the show of support for doing that, is going to move the potential to get some things opened up maybe a little sooner?
Clearly wearing a mask makes you very aware that these are not normal times. And the hope is that if more people wore masks and did good social distancing, stayed home when they were ill, that we could open up a bit earlier. As it looks now, we're seeing places that may be still locked down for another couple of weeks. This is getting old for a lot of people, and it would really, really be nice to be able to open this sooner.
So, Laura, talk about what you're doing with, for instance, your strike team and folks that are involved in some of the areas there at Douglas Public Health Network.
Sure, Kyle. So our EPI strike team is busy identifying contacts of known cases. Our new positive today was actually identified through that process. The patient was mildly ill and might not have noticed that they had COVID-19 if they hadn't been notified by our EPI strike team. And that is a good sign. If we see new cases, if they're contacts of previously known cases, that means that we have a good handle on what's happening locally.
And how's the process go when you do these, connecting up with people and figuring out who their significant connections are? What's the process like?
So we receive new lab reports every morning, and we go through those negative and positive. And the positives we will call. If we can't get a hold of them by the first number, we'll try other ways of contacting them. And usually that interview with them takes about an hour. And we go through, we use a calendar, we go through everywhere that they've been and people they've been around during their contagious period. And we define that contagious period by 2 days before their symptoms started.
And how busy, how many people are you keeping busy, I guess, is what I want to ask in terms of this strike team?
Boy, it's a big process. So we have 6 new EPI strike team members. 2 are retired nurse practitioners. 2 are school nurses that are currently less busy due to school closures. And then 2 are Aviva staff that are helping us with the contact tracing. We have Brian Mahoney and Kristen Rutledge, 2 of my coworkers that have helped with training and data entry, and they also have made phone calls to keep abreast of this. The thing is, we never get just one case per day. We'll have several days without a case, and we get 3 all in one day. And so you still have to call those 3 all on the same day and call all their contacts. So we're pretty good at teamwork here, and we work together to make sure everybody gets notified.
And I imagine there's a lot of paperwork that you have to file in conjunction with all this as well.
Well, it's all online. So the infectious disease database we use in Oregon is called Orpheus, and all of that is tracked electronically. And so the state sees our data, and we see the rest of the state's data all instantly.
And how different is that than, I mean, backing up even 10, maybe 15, 20 years, especially being able to have that ability now versus a situation in the past when, you know, you'd be mailing information back and forth and all that kind of thing?
Well, I'm fairly new in my public health career, so I can't speak to what it was like 10 years ago, but I have had colleagues like Brian Mahoney who have told me the way they used to do it all by paper, and they'd have a folder with cases and then their associated contacts. And it's different now, but the principles remain the same.
And Dr. Bob, you've been around long enough to remember those differences. Even in normal days, the fact that all these different health organizations can communicate and government agencies so rapidly has got to make a big difference.
Well, it clearly does, and I think the amount of cooperation among the different health agencies is great. For example, we have access to some of the electronic health records in town, and rather than calling, asking for some information, waiting for someone to gather it and send it back, we can now look at that directly. So it really does help.
All right, going to take a break and do another segment when we come back. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, infectious disease epidemiologist at the Douglas Public Health Network, getting an update on COVID-19 response here in Douglas County. In for Lisa Platt, this is Talking Health. I'm Kyle Bailey. 4:36, back in 3 minutes on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon, 4:39, 21 minutes away from 5. The afternoon report coming up with Douglas County's news team. And in for Lisa Platt, Kyle Bailey with Talking Health. Our special focus during this time of COVID-19 is on the Douglas Public Health Network and the response that's going on around Douglas County as we sort of try to unpack some information to keep you updated. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, infectious disease epidemiologist at DPHN. So Dr. Bob, I know that you're staying very busy, probably in multiple locations throughout the day.
I am. We're doing the testing clinic here and in Reedsport. I've been working with the Emergency Operations Center, working with phone calls, doing shows like this, and doing another Facebook Live tonight.
And that is going to be at 6 o'clock. Talk about how those work.
So we do these on Facebook Live. We have several hundred or thousands of people who watch us. We let people put in their questions, and we just answer the questions as they come up.
And so this is kind of a bit of a gritty way to address things. How's it been going doing that?
It's been great. Actually, it's been interesting to see the questions that people have. For the most part, people have been incredibly kind, and that's a good thing.
Let's talk about your role on the governor's task force. I don't remember the exact name of the group, but a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, you were named as one of eight folks providing some advice from the health side for the governor. Talk about the work of that group.
So this is a group that the governor has to put together to help her to do two things. One is to find blind spots, and that's always important during a time like this because it's easy to get so focused that you miss something, and then also to point out pinch points or things that are going to be problems along the way. And so the group has been working with her. We've been meeting several times a week. We're going to meet again tomorrow and give her our best advice.
How long do those meetings tend to last?
Well, hour or two. I will tell you that there's a bunch of people there who really want to get their points out. So it's been quite the interesting group.
And are you given, prior to meetings, things to look at, data the governor wants your group looking over, et cetera?
So we've been fortunate to have very good data. In fact, they update the models of what it looks like every week, and we get a briefing about the very latest models.
This is probably, you in many years back, were often called upon by the governor, the legislature, committees in particular, to provide insight and advice as Douglas County was kind of leading the way in some things around the state. What's it like to have so many folks who have the background and the experience and the knowledge and sort of get everybody together in one place?
Well, for me, it's tremendously exhilarating because I always like to be among people who are really smart and will challenge me academically about what's going on. So this is a group of people who are super smart. I'm not sure the reason I'm there, but these are really smart. These are really smart people, and we truly are putting out blind spots for the government.
Do you feel like folks are being pretty transparent about what they think? I mean, I know that oftentimes when you're asked to provide advice to someone much higher up, sometimes a lot of folks would tend to be wanting to provide maybe what they think the person wants to hear or provide something more simplistic. How seriously are people taking this that are on the group?
Well, the people in the group are taking it tremendously seriously. I mean, it always is difficult in a situation like this to avoid groupthink. Everybody says, that kind of seems fine, and don't really look at the other problems. And I will tell you, this is a group that clearly will point out blind spots.
And how is the governor, what kind of responsiveness are you seeing from her on that?
Well, she's at each one of these meetings, and she's tremendously involved and quite knowledgeable about the entire picture.
And you really have kind of the rural voice of this group. What kinds of things have you been able to add to the conversation?
Well, I think the rural voice is not that much different from everybody else. However, the number of cases in rural areas is considerably lower than the number of cases in the Portland area. So if you look at the cases in Oregon, they really do seem to be mostly in the upper Willamette Valley and around Deschutes. Actually, very low number of cases starting from Lane, south, and east.
And that has brought the call from some to take the idea that maybe as restrictions change, as different areas meet benchmarks that the governor mentioned, that maybe there would not be the weight to have the entire state move from one phase to the next along the way. Any sense as to whether that's going to be looked at?
We'll definitely look at that. I don't think I can give you the answer to that. We'll tell you, however, the rural areas say, hey, we haven't had a lot of cases, but if they do have a case, they're not going to care for it in their local area. They will send it to one of the other areas. So I think we have to realize that as a state, we're kind of interdependent.
Interesting. And obviously, there's been a lot of interest in that because of the economic issues. How does that side of it play into the discussion you're having?
Well, the economic issues are very interesting and really important. But what I've told the economists, if they'll stay out of public health, they'll stay out of economics. And so I think we're going to use both the expertise of the economists and the public health together.
And any scenario in terms of basically, is this group together until it's not needed? Is that kind of the way it's set up?
I think we're going to serve with the pleasure of the governor, and as long as she wants me to serve, I will.
So talk about some of the other things people ought to know about the COVID-19 situation here. I feel like so many people listening are getting perhaps much more than they even maybe want of an education in medicine. How many things are being adjusted due to COVID-19 that maybe society should have considered adjusting a long time ago for other health reasons?
So I think this will get us a chance to rethink about how people's insurance is linked to their employment. Because we've seen over these last few weeks as people have filed for unemployment, not only have they lost their job, but they've lost their health care, and this has caused a big disruption. So I think at some point we're going to look at the connection between health care and employment. I think one of the other things that I pointed out several times on the Facebook Live is I think this should really encourage people to have a primary care doctor. So when you have a question about, like, oh, I'm really scared about this or that, somebody you can talk to and trust about your health issues. And the residency, the family practice residency at the Aviva, it will be starting this summer, and that will be a chance for people who do not currently have a primary care doctor to get one, because they're going to be seeing all comers. So that would be great to do. I think the other thing that this is going to have us reconsider is our investment in public health. So public health over the years has been kind of left to wither in many places, not so much in Douglas County, but in other places, really quite left to wither because there hasn't been a lot of public health problems. Well, I think now we recognize that we really should not let public health wither, that public health is important. It's important to be there just in case. Just like you wouldn't say, geez, we haven't had any fires over the last couple of weeks, let's get rid of the fire department, realizing that even though you may not have any fires over the last couple of weeks, they certainly could come up at any point. And it takes a while to go ahead and build the equipment, the people, the expertise, and the systems to deal with fire should it occur.
So you're saying then that probably we need to have more of a built-in infrastructure and that's able to maybe maintain a base of more people employed. And then much like, for instance, the local fire agencies, Douglas Forest Protective, et cetera, be ready to add people when bigger situations come along, but still have a base of operations that's maybe bigger than it is at this point, or at least that it was before all of this began?
Well, we've used a lot of analogies to fire with this. And again, just like the fire department doesn't go out on fire calls each day, they do other things. They do ambulance and other calls. And just like public health is not dealing with pandemic every day, we do other things like tobacco prevention and whatever, but we're ready just in case something like this should happen. And just like the fire department drills endlessly to get ready for potential situations, we too have drilled quite a bit over the last few years. For example, we've done the drive-through flu clinic, and the drive-through flu vaccination clinics were absolutely helpful for us now to start our drive-through testing clinics. Most other counties have not been able to do this through public health. Most other counties have been doing their testing through hospitals or other systems. We're one of the few counties that have done this through public health.
Got to take a break. Our final segment when we come back, County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Douglas Public Health Network. A two-minute break. Back with our final segment of Talking Health. In for Lisa Platt, I'm Kyle Bailey on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Final segment of Talking Health with Douglas Public Health Network this week. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and an infectious disease epidemiologist Laura Turpin, DPHN. Dr. Bob, in the segment, I kind of want to open it up for just general thoughts that you've been thinking about regarding this situation and maybe information that people should know that maybe we haven't been getting to all the time.
I think you've done a great job in covering the information. I think we have so many different ways to get the information out. We do our daily press releases. We have these shows. We have the noon shows. We have the Facebook Live. I think the information is out, and I just would ask people if they've got questions to give them to us. A few things I would ask people, be gentle. This is for every one of us, our first pandemic, and we're not going to do everything right, although we're going to try really hard to do that. The second thing that I would ask is that people really take some time to take good care of themselves. Go outside on this beautiful weather, get some sunshine. Exercise is fine as long as you social distance and get all those things ready, because this will be over, and when it is, we're hoping that people stay in good shape.
Laura, for your vantage point, what about things maybe you've been wanting to share with people?
I think if there is one message I could tell Douglas County residents is that a lot of patients that we've had have thought that they haven't had COVID-19 because their symptoms are quite mild. I think that the message would be, if you have any sort of symptoms like fever, cough, maybe you don't have a fever, but you have congestion or nausea or diarrhea, you're not quite sure what it is, consider COVID and please stay home. Follow the guidelines regarding what to do if you're sick, and don't assume that just because your symptoms are mild that you don't have it, or think that it's allergies.
Dr. Bob, you know, one of the things, and you kind of touched on this earlier, a lot of folks, even with good health care insurance and that, don't always utilize it. Some folks just go to urgent care clinics when they get that bad winter cold, things like that. How important is it for people to be connected with regular medical professional who's seeing them on some kind of scheduled basis?
Well, I think it's very important, and I think the difference in this is that generally, if you had a mild cold, we would not be recommended to go to the doctor. But in this case, I would exactly agree with Laura that if you have a symptom which suggests COVID, that you should indeed get tested.
And there's oftentimes a reluctance. People just want to fight it out. They say, I'll be fine in a few days. But this time around, the stakes are a lot higher.
Well, the stakes are a lot higher. Regular colds don't wind people up in the hospital. They don't wind people up in the ICU. And if you happen to give your elderly grandparents a mild cold, it's unlikely to really hurt them very much. In this case, what for a young person might be a mild cold might be for a senior a critical illness.
I want to ask about the timing of all of this. The first time you connected with me was somewhere in, I think, mid-January about this situation. Some people have wondered about the virus, if it could have possibly been around sooner. I've heard stories of folks, even in our area, who talked about around Christmas or maybe a little bit earlier, just this horrific what seemed like flu to them situation. Kind of trace us back to the timeline of all of this with COVID-19.
So we believe that COVID-19 started somewhere in November or December, somewhere in China. And the exact etiology we don't know, but the best thought is that this came from bats and pangolins and then probably spread to the U.S. The first cases in late January in Washington. It didn't really hit Oregon until mid to late February. Now, there are a lot of people who swear they had this in January or February, and when the antibody tests come out and are widely available, they will truly be interesting to see if indeed people did have this back then. So the antibody test, if you had this in January or February, should show a large amount of antibodies in your blood at this time. So we're encouraging anybody who thinks they were sick during that January and February time to have a test and find out. Now, we've gotten some of these antibody test results back from other areas, from China, from Iceland, from Los Angeles, and it shows that less than 5% of each of those populations has tested positive for antibodies. So people were sick with something, but I don't know if it was COVID.
And so if people were very sick, especially December, November, then at this point you don't feel like the data shows that that could have been COVID-19 at that point?
I don't know. And that's why we do tests. I mean, if I knew the results of the tests, we wouldn't have to do them. I do not know the results of these tests, but I do think that I would bet that most of those illnesses were not COVID. But again, that's why we do testing.
And testing, you talked about just like the public health networks and all of that. I mean, every time we get a situation where there's a need to ramp up testing for whatever the purpose, it seems like it's every virus is a little bit different. None of these situations, SARS, et cetera, have been the same.
Yes, they're all very different. You know, if you think of viruses being, say, like different automobiles, they're all kinds of different kinds. There are some that look similar but are very different brands, and then there are some that sort of follow in the same pattern. So, for example, the flu virus changes every year, much like the model of a car may change every year. And so, and just because they change every year, you need a new test every year for the different viruses.
All right, just about out of time before the music starts. Again, Dr. Bob, remind folks about the Facebook Live event coming up in just over an hour.
Okay, so we're going to have Facebook Live in Facebook Live at 6 o'clock on the Douglas Public Health Network site, and we'll see you then and answer your questions.
All right, and if you've gotten questions based on listening to the interview, let them know about it tonight. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin, infectious disease epidemiologist at the Douglas Public Health Network. Folks, thanks for being on today.
Thanks for having
us. All right, that wraps up Talking Health for today on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.